2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the technical net, as we do most Sunday evenings, starting at 8, quite often going as long as 4 hours, sometimes up till midnight, if there's enough questions and items to be discussed. You guys have heard so often the main purpose of the technical net is education. Curious radio amateurs gather here to find out more about how wireless equipment really works. They want to know more about their antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio that there are. This net started way back in 1982. That makes it, what, 35 years ago? 34 and a half. It'll be 35 in September. September 1982 is when it began. N2FDJ and I, HIPAA, thought that we would, together on Sunday evenings, answer people's questions. And in a couple of weeks, the questions will all be answered. We'd dry up and go away. 35 years ago, we discovered there's a huge thirst for knowledge on wireless equipment. There's always a whole bunch of new people joining the hobby. New people joining another one of the 27 kinds of ham radio. They may have been on HF and suddenly discover 2-meter FM and the technical net. A person who does have a question or a comment for the net signs in by giving us your call letters, your name, try to remember to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes. The word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Don't have to sign in just because you're listening. We used to have long lists of, we used to have long lists of people just listening, and it doesn't gain us anything. After 35 years of essentially uninterrupted tech nets, over 5,000 hours worth of them, by now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't require confirmation. And in the last few years, Eric has added EchoLink and IRLP, so we sometimes get sign-ins and certainly get listeners from various far-off states and other countries. And sometimes they sign in, and we welcome them. So, if you do have a question or a comment, give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2 Romeo India Whiskey, TechNet, we're listening.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes.
WB2JOB, Bob, yes.
WS2N, Paul at the Space Report. But I want to make one comment before it gets too late, because I have something that the time is going to run up on. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. So far we've got Joe, Bob, and Paul to sign in. Anyone else, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RI, if you're listening.
Did you get to be an LK2?
Yes, I did. Now, Brookhaven National Laboratory is holding a very nice thing called the Summer Open House Summers or something like that. Science. I went today and I'll give you some report as to what I found, both good and bad. Mostly good. And that was from Eric. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
And to you, portable. In the hospital.
Okay, Rich, we heard you quite well.
KD2WG.
Okay, we got Rick. KD2-something-WG. Angel, please give me your full call letters again. Kilo-Delta-2-something-WG.
Kilo-Delta-2-November-Whiskey-Golf.
November-Whiskey-Golf. We got you, Angel. One last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment? We can call it as a name right now.
Rick, I just want to make a comment.
Okay, so far we got two people who want to make a comment. Both Paul and Rick, in that order. Paul, go ahead with your comment. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about an ISS, International Space Station, pad that's going to come over Long Island tonight at 10:57 p.m. Now, you're not going to be able to see it because it looks like it's cloudy out. It's a 6.5 minute duration, and it's going to be 77 degrees at its high point, so which would have really been good, 10:57 plus 6.5 minutes. But that doesn't stop anybody from trying their frequencies. You know, they have ham radio on board. Sometimes when they go over these busy cities, they might, you know, they could always be listening. And if not, they have a repeater system. So, you know, you could listen for them anyway on 2 meters on 145.800. I have the other frequencies if you want for repeater use. Back to Dick.
Yeah, if the sky was clear, the International Space Station, when it's up in sunlight and we're down here at dusk, can give you a pretty nice bright object going across the sky. And from horizon to horizon, it takes a minute, if it was going straight overhead at your house. But because of the overcast now, I think you're not going to be able to see it. And the International Space Station is nowhere near as bright as an iridium flash. When the iridium flash occurs, the whole flat surface of the phased array of that GPS satellite, of that iridium satellite, when it's properly oriented, it makes a very bright spot on your town. And even on a very heavily overcast night, on two occasions I've gone out there during an overcast, looked for the iridium flash through the clouds and saw it. So that's nice and bright. You don't have any great big flat surface on the International Space Station that can aim at you like that. So, do you think there's a chance that if somebody knows what frequencies to listen to when it passes over tonight at, I think it's at 10:57 is when it starts, what are those frequencies where people should transmit or listen if they wanted to try to talk to the International Space Station? And there's some chance that the hams on board might be operational now, even though they might not have previously announced it. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, the visual starts at 9:57 Eastern Standard Time, and it lasts 6.5 minutes. But radio contact usually is a minute or two before for visual. Visual starts when we see it at 10 degrees above the horizon, goes to a peak of 77 and then drops off, and then it's going to drop off around 10 degrees again on the horizon, starting from the southwest going up to the northeast. So if you look southwest at that time, you would normally be able to see it. But radio-wise, yeah, it's, for 2 meters, we would be listening to 145.800. If you have the, a lot of modern radios take some time to get these odd frequencies in. If you wanted to actually transmit up to it, it's 144.490. And it's for Region 2. If you were somewhere else in Region 3 or something, they use different frequencies. But that's for us. Generally, I'll put on 145.800 and try to hear something. The other one, they actually have a repeater on board, a UHF, VHF repeater, with an uplink of 437.800, and that's for UHF uplink, and then, but it comes down on 2 meters. Again, it comes down on 145.800, the same one. So that's it. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Okay, there's a slight confusion here, Paul. Two transmissions ago, you said that this event will occur in our area at 10:57 local time. On your last transmission, you said 9:57 local time. And when it comes to the uplink frequency on 2 meters, did you say that was 144.984? I'm not quite sure. I didn't write it down correctly. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I don't remember saying 10, but if I did, sorry about that. Maybe I said around 10 o'clock, but 9:57 Eastern Standard Time. Visual there, a couple of minutes before with the radio. And for FM, yeah, you would have to transmit on 144.490. So that's a strange frequency. I guess they do that for certain reasons. But the downlink, what you're listening to is 145.800. So you never know if they're transmitting. Somebody could be transmitting up, trying to use their repeater, and you could be going up on 437.800. But they're also, you know, they have it where it's coming down. It's coming down on 145.800, that same number, that same frequency, for general 2-meter use. That's the way they do it. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I think the chances of the sky clearing up between now and 9:57 are not very good. But it's worth a try. And with any further questions or comments, any fills needed on what Paul just told us, give me a call that is right now, K2LAW. There being none, the second person who's got a quick message for us is Rich, N2EO. N2EO, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
This is N2JTV Mobile listening.
N2 Juliet Tango Victor. Are you signing in because you have a question or a comment for the technical net? JTV K2RIW.
No, I'm just checking out my a new antenna back in my car. I'm checking it out, over.
Okay, you're dead for quieting in the machine and your audio sounds good. First person on our list who's got a real question or a comment was Joe, W2RYY. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Is this the Limark repeater?
This is the Limark repeater, and we're in the middle of a net right now. W2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. My question had to do with the Bessel function. I like to understand the mathematics behind that, because how I understand it works is concerning FM transmissions. If you have a signal, like say out of a signal generator, and you generate 1,000 hertz, when you have the level go up to 2.45 kilohertz, you will get your first null. And if you take that a step further, if you change your audio frequency to, I believe it's like 2040.81 hertz, and increase your level, now you'll get a null when you have 5 kilohertz of deviation being produced. It's a good way to check your service monitor to see if it's deviation reading correctly, but I'm kind of interested in the knowing the mathematics behind that, how that actually was derived, if so, if you happen to know something.
Sidebands. Let me drop. And if you go to the reference data for radio engineers, among other texts, there's a number of texts where you can look up Bessel functions. And they give you a chart, a graph, they give you a lookup table, a spreadsheet. There's all kinds of ways they present the data. But for each individual amount of modulation index, let me describe what that means. Let me drop. I could deviate plus or minus 1 kilohertz in FM modulation and do it at a 1 kc rate. Modulation index is described as delta F over F sub M. Delta F is how much you're deviating. F sub M is the frequency of modulation. So 1 kc of deviation at a 1 kc rate would be a modulation index of 1. If I deviated to 2 kc, it would be a modulation index of 2, and so on. 2.4 kc of deviation at a 1 kilohertz rate. If I went to a 2 kilohertz rate, I'd have to use a larger amount of deviation in order to have the same modulation index. So Bessel functions work as a function of modulation index. The number of sidebands that are significant. If I keep the modulation index constant, the number of sidebands that are created are the same. Let me drop this. I don't know the exact number, but with a modulation index of 2.4, maybe it's only the first 4 or 5 sidebands are significant. And even if I go to a much higher deviation magnitude, but at a much faster rate, I'll have the exact same modulation index, and again, I'll have the same 4 or 5 subbands that'll be significant in amplitude. But because I'm deviating at a faster rate, they're all spaced at a greater distance. One way of looking at this is that as you go to a higher frequency, one of the definitions of frequency is the rate of change of phase. So during the time I'm at the positive deflection of frequency, in other words, there's a positive voltage coming out of my microphone, and that deviates my voltage-controlled oscillator, my FMing oscillator in my radio, in a positive direction. So instead of being on 146.85 or 146.850, I'm 853. I'm going to 3 kilohertz of peak deviation at that time. During that period of time, the rate of phase coming out of my transmitter is increasing. In other words, how fast I'm going through 360 degrees of RF modulation going to the antenna. So you're accumulating phase on the positive deviation, taking it away on the negative deviation. Your average is going to be the same. Your average frequency is 146.85. But you're spreading yourself across a certain amount of spectrum. Let me drop. The Bessel functions are a fairly complicated piece of mathematics. I've written a program that will calculate Bessel functions for me. And it's an infinite series program, is the one that I wrote. That do it to 12 decimal places in a couple of seconds on my HP calculator. So looking it up in the book, coming up with a program that calculates it, it's not a simple equation. I mean, in the case of trigonometric functions, if somebody asks me what is the sine of 30 degrees, the sine of 30 degrees is always 0.5. Just plug in 30 degrees, measure the sine, and you get an answer. Bessel functions don't work quite like that. The lookup table, yes, gives it that way, but to mathematically calculate it, it's kind of nasty. However, each of the individual side lobes that are spaced from the carrier, you'll see them on a spectrum analyzer. Let me drop. At first, they all start off at 0 magnitude. As you slowly increase the modulation index, they all come up to a peak at some particular modulation index, and then they start oscillating up and down from there. They go both positive and negative. Negative in phase, of course, but they're represented as positive and negative energy. And each individual one hits its peak at a different modulation index. Each individual side lobe hits its first null, at a different modulation index. So they're moving up and down at a complicated rate. And to really calibrate your receiver, in other words, if I want to set my receiver so that my audio deviates exactly plus or minus 2.4 kilohertz, to have a frequency discriminator that is perfectly calibrated, traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. That's a difficult thing to do. However, if you're looking with a spectrum analyzer and looking at the first side lobe and somewhere at approximately 2.4 kilohertz, that's at around 1 or 1.5 kilohertz, the first side lobe hits a peak in magnitude, and as you keep going to greater modulation index, it starts coming back down and goes to zero. So with a good spectrum analyzer to see when the first side lobe goes to its first zero amplitude, to pick that off the screen on the spectrum analyzer, you can do that with extremely high accuracy. Very little traceable to the bureau is required, just as long as you know that you're really modulating at a 1 kilohertz rate. So in order to have the system calibrated, when you think you're transmitting, you think you're deviating at a 1 kilohertz rate, you've got to make sure that that's accurate. If it's higher or lower than 1 kilohertz, of course you're going to get some error in the system. But finding a way of getting exactly 1 kilohertz, which I think is one of the frequencies given out by the National Bureau of Standards, tone, I take it back, 660 and 440, I think, are the tones. Oh, yeah, there is a time when it does put out 1 kilohertz. So there's ways you can check the accuracy of your 1 kilohertz by listening to the National Bureau of Standards standard radio signal. Let me drop. And then finding the modulation index, the amount of deviation, the magnitude of the FM, so to speak, that makes the first side lobe go to zero, or the second side lobe go to zero if you want the higher modulation index, that you can pick off very precisely off that spectrum analyzer. Even if the spectrum analyzer itself is not well calibrated in amplitude or frequency, that null will still exist, if you know what I mean. So that's some of the story. The real math behind Bessel functions, oh boy, you Google those words, Bessel functions, and start reading it, you're going to see a whole lot of mathematical vocabulary. You'll see a whole lot of very fancy equations and derivations. And after plowing through that, I think there's an 80% chance the first two times you plow through it, Joe, you're going to say, what in the world is going on? Isn't there a simpler way of explaining it? I've said those exact words on the microwave reflector on a couple of occasions. And after all these years, nobody has come back with a nice, simple answer on that one. W-A-2-L-Y-Y. K-2-L-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
D-D-H with a comment?
Yeah, that's what I should have said when I told you this at the beginning. Yes, I was observing this on a spectrum analyzer. And I'm noticing now what I calculated that. If you tell me the modulation index is deviation divided by tonal frequency, and that gives you modulation index, 2.45 divided by 1 is 2.45. 5 divided by 2.2040.81 gives you the same thing, 2.45. That's, I guess, what I was getting at, maybe. It seemed like it's a complicated formula, but I just wonder, it seemed like if you hold that modulation index at 2.45, and I do understand that the higher the frequency you go, you have to increase the deviation to maintain the same modulation index, and it seems that when you hit that, you're hitting that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KDH recognized, get you in a second. The first half of what you said was accurate. If I'm using a 1 kilohertz audio oscillator into the microphone circuit, and I deviate, I set the FM modulation deviation, modulation index, high enough to 2.45, I get that first null. If I want the second null at 5 and a fraction modulation index, I keep the modulating rate, the 1 kilohertz, constant. I don't change that. Set it the other way around. Maybe you didn't mean it. So I keep putting a 1 kilohertz tone into the microphone and increase the FM deviation until I get the that first side lobe going through a null the second time. Let me think now. Is it the first side lobe going through a null the second time, or is it the second side lobe going through a null? By way of the Bessel function curves that you can find in reference data for radio engineers, we'll pin that one down very slow, very, very fast. But a greater modulation, I'm pretty sure the first side lobe goes to a null a second time at 5 in a fraction. So at those two points, yes, you know your deviation is exact. And if you want some other exact amount of deviation for the setting of your transmitter, choosing the right tonal frequency and the right null, by way of the Bessel functions, you can always get it with as much accuracy as you desire. Well, let's go Bob at Lake Kilo Delta Hotel. Give me the full call and your name and your comment, sir. KDH question mark K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Oh, yeah, fine. This is Dick. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's WA2ZD. Very dignified ham. A couple of comments. First of all, I think it's the carrier frequency spectral line that goes to a no, and that's the one that follows J sub 0 of beta. And its nulls are 2.405 and 5.52. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for that correction, John. Now I recognize exactly what you're saying. WA2 Victor Delta Hotel, he's right. It is the carrier that goes to the thing. Now it's making sense. As the audio coming out of your microphone goes to a positive voltage, and depending on the polarity of your audio system, let's assume that creates positive deviation of your FM, your voltage-controlled oscillator. So during that period of time, you're accumulating phase. When the voltage out of your microphone goes negative, the amount of phase coming out of your transmitter, you're at a slightly lower frequency during that period of time, you're subtracting phase. So at a particular modulation index, phase going positive and the phase going negative, you could say it cancels each other, and you get a null at the carrier. So before you start talking to the microphone, you set your transmitter at 146.85, and if it's a 40-watt transmitter, you'll see 40 watts coming out of the transmitter at that frequency, 146.850. And as you increase the modulation index, you're generating side lobes. If you're whistling into the mic at a 1 kc rate, you're creating a whole bunch of side lobes, 1 kc up and down, 2 kc up and down, and so on. You're putting energy into those side lobes. Gotta come from somewhere, conservation of energy. It comes from the carrier. The fancy thing about a FM transmitter is the amount of power going into that dummy load, the amount of power going into your bird watt meter, whatever. As long as everything is working correctly on your transmitter, whether you're talking to the mic, whether you don't talk to the mic, whether you shout into the mic, if it's a 40-watt transmitter, you'll see exactly 40 watts all the time. Let me drop.
Okay, there, Jack.
Eric, recognize. Stand by. So the power output stays constant, but that power is being subtracted from the carrier to go into those side lobes. So at a particular magnitude of the side lobes, a certain modulation index, the carrier goes to zero. There are modulation indices where the first side lobe, second side lobe, and third side lobe, they also go to zero at some other modulation index. But most people use the carrier null because it's a lot easier to identify, and it comes out to more convenient numbers. In the case of an AM transmitter, by comparison, full 100% modulated AM transmitter, if I was building a 1 kilowatt AM transmitter, I'd have to build, if it's a high-level modulator, if I'm modulating the final stage, the old-fashioned way of doing it with high fidelity, I needed 500 watts of audio. Half the amount of power of your carrier must be generated by the audio system in an AM modulated transmitter. Let me drop. So therefore, when I set my transmitter up and I go key down and I got a kilowatt out and registered on the bird watt meter, for instance, or into my dummy load, and then I whistle into the mic of an AM modulated transmitter, and I go to full 100% modulation and hold it, my bird watt meter will show 150 watts of output. The upper side lobe and the lower side lobe have one quarter of the amount of power, and they suddenly appear. The carrier doesn't change one iota in amplitude in an AM modulated transmitter, and you're really putting out more power when you modulate. FM doesn't do that. So the side lobes, you can generate it with AM without affecting the carrier. With FM, you gotta select the power from somewhere. I could have a 1 kilowatt FM transmitter. I could modulate it with 1 milliwatt of audio going into that oscillator. That's the beauty of it. But it's got this crazy vessel function characteristic where periodically the carrier disappears for brief periods of time. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. While you were talking about this, I pulled out a little card out of my pocket. You set up the FM transmitters. I keep a list of the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth carrier nulls. Deviation ratios I'm working with a little more precise than what you heard before. It's actually
The first carrier null is 2.40466. The second carrier null is 5.51998, and so on and so forth. And I will set for what we consider to be average program level, because we use a sine wave, and of the correct amplitude. And to get the first null at 75 kilohertz worth of deviation is 31.1894 kilohertz. But generally you use a second null because some systems won't pass that. So the second null would be 13.5870 kilohertz. And in the days when we're doing analog TV, there you're doing plus or minus 25 kilohertz, and the frequencies are considerably different. K2RW, K2J, just throw that in.
That's good information, Eric. See, in the case of FM high-fast broadcast, the transmitting frequencies between 88 and 108 megacycles, the FM on your dial, rare full 100% modulation is considered 75 kilohertz, plus or minus 75 kilohertz. So that's a modulation. If you're doing it at a 1KC rate, that's a modulation index of 75. Whereas when you and I set up our transmitters like the one you're listening to right now, we tend to set up a modulation index close to 5. So you got real broadband FM by ham radio standards when you're on FM broadcast between 88 and 108 megs.
Otherwise, the peak level is 237 kilohertz, and so the total bandwidth is all the stuff.
So the instantaneous frequency goes that high because 75 kc of audio, and then your subsidiary carrier authorization, your 19 kilohertz pilot tone, your 38 kc stereo, your 67 kc Muzak, and all of that jazz. When you add all of that jazz together, I think you're saying the absolute peak, very low probability, but the absolute peak is 200 and some odd kilohertz. Is that what you just told us, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Now, your absolute peaks will wind up to be 237 plus or minus, of course. That is when you finally add all the rest of the stuff. But when you're setting up a transmitter, of course, now, most people don't have an awareness that there's pre-emphasis that's provided in the transmitter. When you're doing this kind of stuff, you got to shut it off. So, yeah. And actually, today, if you look at your FM dial on your spectrum analyzer, you'll see what looks like two little flat top, but they look like DTV signals on both the left and the right side of the FM carrier. And by the way, you'll see that in the AM too. That's the digital radio.
In order to set the correct audio amplitude on an FM broadcast transmitter, 88 to 108 megs, correct audio, correct magnitude of 19 kilohertz pilot tone, correct magnitude of the 38 kc for the stereo, the correct magnitude for the 67 kc, if that's what it is for Muzak. Do you go through a Bessel function nulling process on each one of those individual functions, Eric, in the worst case, a Calcet requirement, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
You, in essence, could, but we don't, because it's a little more complicated, because where you're mixing the SCA, or you're mixing the RDS, which is mixed to display on your car radio. By the way, that's a 57 kilohertz. The FCC specifications allow you to do that at the injection level, so once you've established where 75 kilohertz is, it means that you've already set up the gain, and it's a pretty linear function, the way the audio path through the transmitter is. So, and the way the injection is done for some of the subcarriers is in percentage of total carrier.
So once you've calibrated the main audio channel, and you know the ratio of audio magnitude versus the 19 kc, the 38 kc, and so on, by that ratio you get the others essentially close enough, is what I think you're saying. If the absolute peak deviation is 230 kilohertz, plus or minus, that implies that you're putting a little bit of energy into the adjacent channel, because each of the FM channels are 200 kc apart. I am guessing they get around that problem by the fact that you allocate the individual licenses such that you tend not to have two stations in the same area, exactly one channel adjacent to each other. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2J. Well, with IBOC, it's even wider. IBOC is a digital format that's transmitted along with the FM carrier. It's actually two transmitters. Same thing in the AM world. Although some folks have tried to do it by way of what they call IF modulation. And it's a bit troublesome. It works, but if you have a digital car radio, if you have ever experienced it, it doesn't work quite well when you get kind of far from the station. But most people don't realize that not only FM but AM, they're actually assigned channel numbers. Channel numbers, the way the FCC allows stations to be put in place, you cannot have adjacent channel numbers. And it works sometimes on both sides. It depends upon how far the stations are away from each other, so on and so forth. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay. So, FM broadcast, 88 to 108 megahertz. Roughly what year did that really get rolling, Eric? Was that approximately 1950 or so when that really got rolling? I know that Armstrong, just before World War II, proved that it works like a charm. But I don't think, and I think the frequencies for FM broadcast were way down at 49 megacycles in the old days. But the FCC, after World War II, finally assigned 88 to 108. Roughly what year did that happen, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, to be quite honest, Dick, I'm not that keen on FM radio history, but I'm a little more knowledgeable of the television history. But there are some stories that I remember, but I don't know if I'm going to repeat them accurately. So if you're really interested, I'll get you that information.
No big hurry, but I think some people would be interested. It's gone through quite a bit of history. But of all the things that keep switching around, the standards by which we transmit over-the-air broadcast television, NTSC, the old system, analog, and now the ATSC 3, the new digital techniques, the 8VSB, and so on. Television is going through all kinds of changes. The frequencies, the channels that we're using, moving all over the place. It looks like FM has been left alone. AM has been left alone. Yeah, we've added extra features, stereo and digital and whatever. But the exact frequencies, the exact powers, the modulation indices, for reasons that are very pleasant, it looks to me like audio broadcast has essentially been left alone. They're not changing the standards very much, and they're not changing the frequencies. Is that roughly true, at least in the United States? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I'm glad you said at least in the United States. In many parts of Europe, and there is no more analog broadcasting in any form, and in many places there's no AM broadcasting. So, and in some places there's no FM broadcasting. It's actually delivered by satellite. The changes that have been made are, as you said, the add-ons, like the digital carriers on both sides of your main carrier. But, you know, we talk about ATSC 1 versus ATSC 3, and the one thing that I haven't spoken about, which is just as interesting, is that we used to send video signals through coax cables. We don't do that anymore. Everything comes out on Ethernet. The switches are Ethernet, the DAs are Ethernet, and oh, the problem, because the standards are not standards yet. K2RIW, K2J.
You said we used to send video through cable. I think cable TV still exists. An awful lot of it has switched over to fiber cable. But there are some still fully operational coaxial cables in the United States. I'm a little confused by that one, Eric. Go ahead.
I may not have spoken clearly enough. I'm talking about the camera in the studio, which connects to a switcher, which might connect to a what used to be a tape recorder, which really is a hard disk device, which then goes to the network to put on your transmitter. And in the days of old, which is maybe less than 5 years ago, everything passed through a piece of cable, a video signal from a camera, attached to a piece of cable that looked like, say, IC-58. It would have miles of it. The camera would connect to, say, a camera would connect to a switcher. You might have six cameras in the studio, so you've got six inputs to the switcher, which is the guy who sits in front of the thing with all the buttons on it and picks which camera is going to be the picture on the air. That's all changed. That's all different now. That needs, you need to be an IT guy in order to work with some of this stuff.
The signal from the camera in the studio back to the switcher that no longer a coaxial cable. Is that some kind of a HDMI cable? Is that an RF link? How is the actual signal from the camera getting now to the switcher, Eric? Go ahead.
Depending upon which manufacturer and how much you're sending, could be on the real low end. It could be an HDMI cable that hooks up to the switcher. At the real high end, it might be a piece of fiber that goes to the camera control unit, and its output could be HDMI, but it's more likely an RJ45 Ethernet connector.
Are there any situations where the camera gets back to the switcher by a wireless link, or is it always a wired link? Fiber or wired link, Eric, go ahead.
Okay, well, for years we've been, you know, when you're in a football stadium, the guy's running around with the camera, you look at the back of the camera, you'll see there's a couple of antennas on the back of it. And somewhere in the studio, in the stadium up high, there's a guy who's pointing a dish at the guy with the camera. That's the old way of doing it. Now, we don't even do that. We take five cell phones and actually put them into a docking station that fits on the top of the camera. And they'll use maybe five or six cell phones or cell phone connections to hook back up to a server at the studio and turn that back into video.
Yes, info. Is that five cell phones in order to have reliability? I think not. Is the actual spectrum coming out of the camera broken up into five frequency regions, and each frequency region is going over a particular cell phone? Which is it, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay. Wrong. That's the way you would do Dolby, is you break it up into different bands of audio and then do your work on it. Now, don't forget, if you're coming out of an HD camera, it's coming at 1.1652 gigabits per second. Right? And when we say cell phones today, cell phones are really not phones, they're data transmitted. So, as you know, on a smartphone, you can search the internet. So what you're doing is you're sending out packets of data. So what we're doing is we're taking this 1.16 gigabits. We might do some bit rate reduction on it and bring it down to, say, 278 megabits per second. And then we'll take that stream, and I'll send the first five bits out of this cell phone path, and the next five bits out of that cell phone path, and the next 10 bits out of that cell phone path, depending upon the systems that you're using. You might even be using multiple carriers. Whereas back at the other end, there's a device that captures each one of these groups of packets, puts them back in the right order, waits for them all to get there before it pushes it on and says, "There's your video."
What happens if one of those five cell phones has a dropout, Eric? Go ahead.
At the reception end, it's smart enough to know that there are a couple of things that can happen. One is the actual way at which the packets arrive become late. You don't know how to deal with that. There is a certain kind of FEC that's included with every packet, so if a packet is missing, it will figure it out and replace it.
The FEC is forward error correcting. A person gave us some call letters, wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Give me a full call and name. K2LIW.
WA2SAY.
WA2SAY. Go ahead, Doug. You don't have to give me your name. 20 dB McGarrett. Go right ahead.
Hiya, Dick. I just wanted to mention you were just a minute or so ago talking about running TV through cables. It has to be at least 18 years ago, I guess, at a Demco, where we decided to run video through Cat 5 cable, and we demonstrated that you could do that very nicely over about 1,000 feet of Cat 5. We actually tried it, and it worked very well. Back to you, Dick.
As long as you choose the right brand name of Cat 5 / Cat 6 cable, I personally use Cat 5 cable to send 915 megahertz RF through two of those twisted pair, one twisted pair of the four twisted pair in there. And I don't remember the dB per 100 feet. It was a pretty big number. But it would support 900 megacycles, just twisted pair, non-coax. So, Thomas, what frequency were you sending through that Cat 5, Eric? And, I mean, Doug first, and then we'll go over to Eric. Go ahead, Doug.
He was sending baseband video, 6 megahertz worth of it, or 5 or so megahertz, whatever it is. But as I say, it worked very nicely. So I didn't want to break up the whole discussion here, but I did want to mention that it certainly worked very nicely. Back to you, Dick.
That's talking about coaxial, or is he talking about Cat 5?
And you probably needed some slant direction. In other words, the higher frequencies were attenuated a little bit more. Eric, was that you wanted to say something? KE2EJ, KQIW?
Yeah, I'll tell you a little story about Cat 5. By the way, to run video, baseband video, or 525 line video through Cat 5, I can give you a pair of, they're essentially balanced with equalizers in them. And you can, and it's good for, you know, a couple, I think it's good for like 2,500 feet. But you start to lose it at the end of that. But that's not where I was going. If you were to take a trip into the city and go to the main facility, where we've got maybe 150 or 200 TV sets at various different places. In the past, we would use, you know, RG6 to pass the entire cable system, which would be channels 2 through, 125 if you want to live in cable land. We do the entire distribution through Cat 5 cable. So there are actually now you can take that whole, you know, 300 megahertz to 400 megahertz worth of TV and pass it around the building through just plain old Cat 5 cable.
Question.
Go ahead, Wes.
I got a little bit confused. I was talking about Cat 5. Was he using about a twisted single pair from Cat 5 with two bubbles on it? But he was using a whole Cat 5 for the transmission, like the Ethernet would do. There are certain problems with that. I've been using it for years, especially with the balloons and the connection of it. And also, we're not dealing, whatever the frequency is, we're not dealing with the RF signal. We're dealing with electrical signal that has a frequency spectrum. Enter it again.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Eric on this one. Eric, a Cat 5 cable, and there is something called Cat 6, a slightly higher quality version of it, has
is more constant.
Got a total of 8 wires in there, 4 twisted pairs. On some of the work that you're doing with Cat 5 cable, are you using all 4 twisted pairs, Eric? KE2EJ, KQIW?
Too much here. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to get the bandwidth that we're talking about. System. I didn't believe it at first when I first saw it. And by the way, Cat 6 actually has a carrier for the 4 pairs of wire. It actually guarantees the spacing between the switched pairs. It uses all 4, and there's an intricate set of balance that are connected to the end of it, which recombines it all. I think, I don't actually know the methodology. I do believe, though, they split it up into different bands, and the balance put it back together. Passes, by the way.
So in the case of Cat 6, you've got this plastic thing that looks like an extruded X, a spline-like thing going down the center of the cable that keeps each of the 4 cables really separated from each other, each of the 4 twisted pairs. And when you're trying to send 1.16 gigabits per second, Cat 5 or a Cat 6 cable, you're probably breaking breaking it up into individual frequencies for the four individual twisted pairs with the balance. That's my guess, Eric. KE2EJ for a correction, K2LIW.
And another question.
Hi, well, you have to stop thinking in the analog domain. In a case where you're saying frequency, we're going to change that into bit rates. What we're going to do is we're going to take that signal and we're going to run it through, in essence, say, a long shift register. And we're going to take different outputs from each one of those shift registers. Then what we're going to do is we're going to put them into a latch, hang on to it for a moment, and then we're going to let it spit out. I'm oversimplifying it, but we're going to let it spit out at a slower rate. At the other end, we're going to put it all back together, and it'll be one stream at that 1.16 gigabit rate. Although, many of the high-end cameras will actually send the 1.16 gigabit down a piece of fiber.
What's the total latency of that system that's doing that gating function that you just described and putting it all back together? What's that latency on average, Eric?
Alright, even with today's 1080i, the frame rate is still 16.6 milliseconds or 33.3 if you want to account for both fields. Interestingly enough, okay, all of our studios are remote from the control room location. What I mean by remote is the control room for the studio here in Plainview is in New York. And the control room for the studio in Lincoln Center is on 50th Street. So, obviously, you can't have any more delay than, say, a field or a frame. Otherwise, things aren't going to work out too well at the other end. You also have to take the audio into consideration is that if you want to have lip sync, you've got to line up with each other. So, the typical delay of some of these paths. And the path can be interesting too. Let me drop. The path can be actually a piece of fiber, say to wherever you're going, or the path can be through a switched network, like a typical router and so on and so forth. Typically, there is delay. There is some latency, but we're talking about latency that's in the order of 2 to 5 or 6 milliseconds, which ain't bad.
Got a comment.
Yeah, we know you got a comment, Wes. Stand by a second. I've seen a hell of a lot more latency than that, Eric, and maybe it's a slightly different function. When the main newscaster, when your anchorman switches over to the man in the street, I can tell the man in the street is not hearing his audio for a couple of seconds, and a couple of seconds later, the man in the street starts talking. There's a lot more latency in that particular electronic news gathering function. What's going on there, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, let me help you with this. Typically, the guy out in the field, he hooks up to his truck. His truck has an antenna that's pointed in another antenna. And it's usually a 2 gigahertz link. And today, no longer is it analog. That's digital, too. Right? And then somehow or other, that gets back to the studio. You've got a guy out on the street, and you're doing a live newscast. You better damn well have a 7-second delay on the system, otherwise you're going to get in big trouble, especially if somebody says something you don't want to go over the air.
Okay, so the delay to make sure that profanity doesn't come through, I can see that. But every one of these remote feed type things where they go live, I can tell that the guy in the street that you're watching on the tube, you see his picture. And the anchor man has passed it over to him saying, you're standing in front of the police station. What did you hear? What do you see? And it takes 1 or 2 seconds for him to hear what the anchor said, and then he starts replying. There's an awful lot more delay in there, Eric, and the fact that delay is always there, I don't think it's always the protection delay that I'm hearing that you're describing, but maybe I am. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
That might be the delay, the uplink and downlink on the satellite frequencies they're using, because that takes a little bit of time for encoding and decoding, Dick.
Now, let me add some more for you. There's a couple of different situations where that occurs. Let's say it's live and there's no profanity delay. In the old days, something like this. You know, on regular FM radio, you have these SCAs, or these sub-carrier services. Well, in the days of analog TV, we had something called a Pro Channel. You know, Pro Channel was another audio sub-carrier that your TV set didn't know about. It was kind of narrow deviation. And let's see, WNET-13 would lease that out to New York One News, and that would be their IFB, or their fallback channel. It's the thing that the guy got in his ear. So in that case, the response was instantaneous because you were local within the area of the TV transmitter, you know, reception area, and, you know, you're talking microseconds in terms of audio delay and stuff like that. If you're newscaster is talking to a guy, he's in New York, and the other one's in Washington, okay, the video path might be through landline paths, or in the old days it might have been a microwave path that came from Washington to New York. Let me let it drop again.
Net.
And the audio for the guy's ISP might have been through the regular switch phone line. Now, today, that little ISP in the guy's ear, and if he happens to be in Washington, D.C., he's using a cell phone network. Now, I don't know if you've ever dialed the U.S. Naval Observatory through a landline and then through a cell phone and noticed the length of time that both of them are, you know, different from one another. That's because of the cell phone being a packet, going into a packet switch network and being combined with all this other stuff. So those packets may be delayed getting to where you're going. Then, of course, the guys in Europe, you know you're going through a satellite, and the audio path is probably going through the satellite too. So that accounts for the 5 and 10 second delays sometimes that you'll see happening as they talk to someone overseas. So IWK2Gen.
When it comes to latency, I'm hearing no delay tonight on 975-375. How did you manage to pull out, sir?
It's been that way for weeks, Dick. I guess you don't listen to 375 that often.
WN2XJN, K2RIW, good, Wes.
K1 Bluebit 4 from the discussion about the crash of cable. Actually, the Cat 5, Cat 6. Cat 5 actually used 4 wires out of 8. So the regular 10-100 phase doesn't use 8 wires at all. There are, however, situations when the 8 hours are utilized, wires are utilized. So you could have, actually, from one Cat 5 or Cat 6, you could have, actually, 2 independent Ethernet connections that could be utilized, either short of the run. But actually, you could do it also. Some people were trying to convert two pairs from the telephone pole to 2 houses, and it works great, and I saw it. So in other words, there was a house, a few blocks, and there was another house, and the guy was able to find those wires. Actually, he was working for the telephone company. And he used 2 pairs, twisted pairs, of the regular telephone wire. And he put the internet from one location to the other. So that was not really internet, it was Ethernet connection to local area network. So that, and the difference between Cat 5 and Cat 6 is number of twists. Correct me if I'm wrong. Can't you actually hear?
The Cat 6 cable is considerably more expensive and has a different kind of construction. It is 8 wires, 4 twisted pairs. But in the case of a Cat 5 cable, the 4 twisted pairs, each individual twisted pair, you could say, is wrapped around the other 3. In the case of Cat 6, there is a plastic spline device going down the whole length of the cable in the center. And it's got in cross-section, it's an X-shaped device. And each of the twisted pair is sitting in one of those individual X's. So there's a very finite distance between each of the 4 twisted pairs with CAD 6. Therefore, the isolation between the pairs must be lots of dBs higher, and the insertion loss at microwave frequencies of each individual twisted pair is quite a bit nicer. The Cat 6 has got a superior insulation.